When I started Relief Valve in August of 2020, it was all about getting through a challenging time during the COVID outbreak. I was looking for work and, like most others, locked in my house waiting for the first vaccines to come along. I wanted to see how others were coping, and while I was at it, learning more about who they were and what they did and how they were dealing with the world. I paused in October of 2021 after 37 interviews, realizing that we were really beginning to move on from COVID. And after a year and a half, I've discovered I really miss talking to other people about what they do and how they go there. So today, I want to rededicate this podcast to sharing the experiences of others, hopefully with interesting stories and maybe the occasional inspiration along the way. Is the Hebrew word for discovery. The Birthright Israel program was initiated in 1994 and is funded by private donors, the Jewish Agency for Israel, and the Israeli government. To be eligible, you have to have at least one parent of recognized Jewish descent or who have converted to Judaism through a recognized Jewish movement and be between the ages of 18 and 27. As of 2022, more than 800,000 participants from 68 countries had participated in a Birthright tour. Birthright Israel trips include airfare from a major gateway city, room, board, and transportation associated with touring the country for a 10-day trip. On today's show, my guests are Nina Levinson, who works in the entertainment industry creating localizations, literally the foreign language versions of popular TV shows and movies, and Jason Rocklin, who is the lead features editor at GameRant, a popular web blog site covering news and interest stories of the video gaming industry. And yes, he's my son. My guests today are Nina Levinson and Jason Rocklin, and they have recently taken the Israeli Birthright tour. Now, Birthright is a program that was started back in the mid-90s, I'm going to say, by the combination of private donors and the Israeli government. And the goal is to give anyone with a background of being Jewish some experience and exposure to the state of Israel. And a lot of people listening to this may not know that anyone who has Jewish blood in them actually has a right to return based on Israeli law, where they can go and become citizens anytime they want. They just can show up and say, I want to be an Israeli citizen, and they can be. And they don't have to go through any kind of naturalization process. They're just granted that based on their birthright. And I'm guessing that this program was set up because in the diaspora around the world, there are an awful lot of people who have never had any kind of experience like that. And of course, Israel is always trying to build up its population and try to end the diaspora and bring everybody back together in the homeland. So that's that about introducing it. Tell me, guys, what made you decide you wanted to go take the Birthright tour?
So I was the one who originally posed the idea to Jason. I'd heard about it through some people before, and I'd done a decent amount of research into it over the past couple of years. I think I was like 19 when I learned about it. And it's been something that I've been interested in doing, and I've kept it in the back of my mind. And around my 25th birthday, I wanted to check back in and just see if they were doing trips now that, you know, because it's still COVID, and if, you know, I was still eligible. And I learned that they've lowered the age restriction now. So at 27 years old, that is the last year that you're eligible for Birthright. It used to be around like 32 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So getting into that, I kind of thought, oh, well, if I really want to do it, then maybe I should start thinking about doing that like sooner than later. And, you know, it's a free trip and they take you to another part of the world, and you get to go on a tour and do all of these amazing, interesting experiences, and it doesn't cost any money. So I thought, hey, yeah, I could do that. That sounds like a great time. And then, of course, Jason being my only other Jewish friend, I had to ask, be like, do you want to go together? Because it would be great to do it on my own, but I think it would be 100 times better to do it with someone I'm really close with and a close friend. So that is what we ended up going for. Yeah.
It's interesting you bringing up the fact that, you know, Birthright's a relatively recent thing. You know, I don't know the exact date either, but like from the 90s, I think you were saying, where it's like, at least from my perspective, it seems like something that's always just kind of been there in the background. You know, it's like, it feels like one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, if you're Jewish, you can just go to Israel, right? Like, it's kind of been a fact of life since, I guess, since Israel was a state. And so when Nina did bring it up to me, I was pretty much interested right away. And it wound up being actually my first time out of the United States. So on top of it just being a chance to go and explore, you know, the Jewish heritage side of things, it was also pretty much an excuse for me to finally get a passport and, you know, get out of here for a little bit and actually try to see a little more of the world, which, at least, you know, I'm sure we might talk about it a little, Nina has much more experience with at this point.
So it's definitely a fascinating place to start. Now, I'm guessing neither of you consider yourselves to be particularly religious. So it wasn't really the religion that drew you to do this. What was the application process to go on the tour like?
So exactly. For me, religion was not a consideration at all. It was actually kind of a deterrent for a long time. I didn't want to go and have a really religious experience for something that I'm just, that's not me and that's not what I'm interested in. So I did do a lot of research in the beginning when I was looking into this at all, just to make sure it wasn't going to be very heavily like religion based. But thankfully, no, not really as much. So for the application process, it was kind of long. It was a long application that you fill out on the website, you pick your dates, you rank which tour groups you want to go on. Then immediately, like the next day, they will call you and try to like figure out your registration and answer any questions. And you get through that and you get through the paperwork and pay your little deposit, which they never tell you exists, but it's $250 deposit. And you get it back at the end of the trip, but that was just something of note, because they do ask you to donate your deposit after you finish the trip, which was interesting. But anyways,
again, the program's funded entirely by, you know, like 90% of it's funded by private donors.
Yes, this is true. So that's the reasoning. But so you do the donation, or you do your little pay and then refund later. But then there is a phone call where they interview you about the reasons that you want to go on the trip. And they do ask you a little bit about your experience with Jewish heritage and religion. And they ask you about your identity a lot. And then after that, you wait a little bit longer. There's a few more paperwork things that you have to fill out, medical forms and such. And then eventually, like a month before your trip, they will like contact you instead of a Zoom call for everybody to be in and get more information out of it. But it was pretty smooth. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, Nina covered most of the like the application process part of that as far as like the Jewish identity question goes. As podcast listeners will probably be able to tell by the similar names here, you're a little bit to blame for me not being super religious guy.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. My philosophy, I myself am not, you know what, you would be third generation now, I guess. You know, my grandparents came over from the old world, mostly Eastern Europe, Russia. And then my parents grew up in that first immigrant generation here in the U.S. And when I was little, really little, they were still fairly heavily involved in those kind of things, right? Because when my mm-hmm. grandparents were alive, my parents were honoring my grandparents. So there would be a kosher house kept briefly for the holidays kind of thing. And my mother's father was alive, we used to go to temple for the high holy days and all that kind of stuff. But my parents themselves were not deeply religious people. So when that generation passed on, things were always about cultural exposure more than any kind of depth to it, right? I don't know that, with the exception of occasions like bar mitzvahs, I spent any time in a temple after my own bar mitzvah going forward. And then what I tried to do, my philosophy was, I want to give my kids the tools they need in case they want to be more religious as they got older, without telling them what they had to do. So, you know, Jason had the traditions in front of him. He was bar mitzvahed. He had his bris, all those kind of things. So if he ever married a nice Jewish girl, he could do it in the temple. Yeah. But I didn't push that stuff on anybody, because for me, I have my own complicated relationship with any kind of religion, and even certainly with some Judaism. So I didn't want to be pushy about it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I did, like you said, I got my bar mitzvah, and, you know, in hindsight, I think I remember it a lot more as like a community function more than a religious function. You know, I remember having my friends there to hang out and see the event, and then I remember sort of the after party we held beyond that. It's probably not entirely the point of it, where you're supposed to, you know, get a better understanding of the Torah and whatever else might be involved, but, you know, it is what it is. And certainly things like, you know, celebrating the holidays, even if we don't do the full temple visits and everything, like, it's, I will say, I'm sure it's a little forward thinking, but that was one of the connections I might have made on the Israel trip itself, is like that the community part of, you know, being Jewish and sort of the way those holidays connect into it was maybe one of the bigger connections I made while going out there.
Mm, okay. Yeah. Growing up, my uncle would do Passover Seder every year. And for him, it was a big deal because he was a very religious man. And he passed that on to his kids. So they became more, far more religious than I was, though not, you know, not walking around in yarmulkes all the time kind of thing. But we always enjoyed the Seder, even though at times it was a little bizarre, for lack of a better way to say it, because my uncle, you know, my uncle was my uncle. And he would stage the whole experience. He would always read the passages in Hebrew and then go back and read them in English afterwards. So a Seder that would take 2 hours would take like four, because we'd be doing it twice, you know, at the same time. But it was fun because it was one of those occasions when the entire family got together every year, which didn't happen all that often. And then, of course, when he passed away, all that stuff kind of sort of drifted. I tried to have a Seder or two here. Couldn't draw any interest from anybody else in the house. And then after a while, just kind of said, okay, we will acknowledge what's going on here right now, and then that's going to be all we're going to do with it. So, mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. So where did you travel? Where did you go? What was the itinerary like?
So we landed in Tel Aviv. What was it? Ben Garrison, I think was
Ben Gurion.
Ben Gurion. Yep.
Showing how much I took out of that, I guess.
He was the founder of the state.
Yes, I know.
He was the first prime minister.
Yes. We visited his grave and everything. Yes.
Yeah.
But we didn't spend too much time in Tel Aviv. We went north first. So okay. We went around the Sea of Galilee was kind of the first like destination we hit.
and we visited a town called Sfat, which is very up in the north, I guess a little bit close to the Syrian border.
Okay.
Yeah, there. And we kind of, in the north, there's not a lot of like cities or anything like that. It's mostly like nature and farmland and kibbutz. So we went to a few of those places. We did like a waterfall hike. It was very nice. And then after that, we drove down past the Western Wall and went to Jerusalem. And I think we spent 3 or 4 days in Jerusalem. And then we went to the middle of the desert for the Bedouin experience, which was never really explained to us by the tour people, like what that was about or for. It was just really cold and not a fun experience, to be honest. At least we could ask the Israelis that were on the trip with us, like what this was about. So we got a little bit of an explanation from them. Tel Aviv.
I was going to say, it's probably worth noting that you know, there was, we left on the trip with about 30 people from the United States who were all taking part in our tour group.
Yeah.
But then a couple of days into the trip, we picked up, was it like five or six actual Israeli citizens who were around our age. And the idea was it was supposed to be a big cultural exchange. You know, we could find out more about sort of the day-to-day lives of Israeli people who are doing various jobs from them. They could find out a little more about American perspectives from us. It was, you know, I don't want to say it was like the best part of the trip necessarily, but it was certainly one of the most like actually informative parts.
My best part of the trip.
For
sure.
I imagine it was fascinating because certainly my generation and the generation before me had a different perspective on Israel than you guys probably do. We were, I'm not going to say you're not supportive of them, but we were more supportive of them, right? They were, you know, having lived through the big formal wars, right? The when the Arab invasions were happening, and with the United States having sort of an absolute support for the state. Now, whether that was simply because they were a reliable ally in a part of the world where it was hard to find reliable allies, or it was because there's enough of a Jewish population in the U.S. that the politicians feel the need to pander a little bit. That's the way it was in my generation. And the world today is a lot more polarized than it used to be back here at home, especially, right? And so that polarization seems to come out in all the kind of thinking, and it's showing up ironically in Israel as well, right? Israel has at the moment probably the most conservative and kind of angry government that it's had in many, many, many years. So what did you get from the interchanges with the people who are living there, and how did it change? What were your perspectives like of what was going on in that part of the world prior to going, and how did it change while you were there?
It's a very difficult
question.
Yeah,
it's a lot to mull over. I will say, at least as a precursor, that we were there when the election took place, and they insulated us from most of it.
Yep.
we were having a nice time in the fancy Jerusalem hotel where it was like, it was Shabbat and, you know, you can just sit around and relax. And we kind of heard that, you know, the election had taken place from someone who was giving us like a lecture about the politics in the area, like later that day.
So yeah.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
What was their perspective on the politics of the day? I'm just curious.
Well, so for the lecture portion that we received, it was given by a British man who had immigrated to Jerusalem and had become an Israeli citizen, I believe. Mm-hmm. And his presentation was really helpful and insightful, I felt. It didn't seem too skewed or polarized or biased. In the most part, he really just like stuck to the facts of history and how things are playing out today. We received probably more biased opinions from the actual Israelis that were on the trip that we spoke to. So it was a good experience to kind of get how they felt about it versus the sort of just informational experience, and then also talk to other Americans on the trip who had, you know, maybe opposite opinions as well. So got a really wide rainbow of everything there.
Yeah. The lecture was interesting because it was coming from the perspective of, like, you know, you can have an understanding of things and not necessarily agree with it, right? So a lot of it was like, okay, let's look at sort of the history of how things have been changed and moved, and, like, obviously at this point there's no changing what happened in the history, and whether you agree with it or not, what's important is you should try to understand, you know, sort of the perspectives of all the parties involved.
Right. Okay. Okay. What were some of the, so you traveled, you went up to the northern tip of the, what was it? The northeastern tip of the country, basically.
Yeah.
Then you spent time at the Sea of Galilee, went down into Jerusalem. You were in the old city.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You went to the wall, the temple wall, the temple mount, right?
We did.
Yes.
How are you affected by any of that kind of stuff?
I have a personal experience I could probably share. So in going to the wall in a group, that was a really interesting experience for me. I didn't grow up in temple and I don't have any religious background. So the significance of the wall is not something I was ever familiar with. And even going there, I probably should have done research beforehand, but we just kind of showed up and I hoped that we would learn a little bit about it, but it seemed like something everyone was just supposed to have already known and internalized. And walking through the old city was really wonderful. It was really beautiful. I really just enjoyed it for the fact that it was just a very cool place to be and just, you know, stuff to see. When we reached the Western Wall, we could see it a little bit far away. It's separated by gender, so the men on the left, the women on the right. Before we were allowed to go up to the wall and, you know, have our experience, they made us get in a circle with everybody on our tour group. And we didn't really know what was happening at first. They just said, okay, everybody circle up. So I thought it was just going to be like, oh, this is the part where they explain it. It was not. It was the part where the tour guide made us all, like, put our arms around each other and start singing Hebrew songs. And I am sure for a lot of people on that trip, that was a wonderful and really positive experience. But for me, it just scared me terribly. It made me so, so deeply uncomfortable. One, because I don't know the words to any of these songs. I have no experience. Mm-hmm. I have no relation to them. Everyone else here seems to know the words and I don't know the words. Terrifying. Worst experience to be in. And then I'm suddenly having my arms around, like, two men that I've never really, like, met until a few days ago. So it's just like, I don't personally want to touch strangers that I don't know. You know, even though we're on the trip together, it's not like we're talking and communicating very much. So it just felt like, oh, okay. And then the songs just kept going. It was like maybe 5 to 6 minutes of just singing verses of these songs, and everybody's holding hands and, like, swaying back and forth. And as it progressively goes on, I just get worse and worse and more uncomfortable with it. And at the end of that, it really felt like whatever spiritual or emotional experience I was having before we got to that point is just gone. I just felt like, oh no, I've stepped into something just uncomfortably religious and I need to get away. So going up to the wall was kind of a weird moment, because then I go and there's women who are praying, and they have their face in the Torah and they're leaning back and forth, and it's a really interesting experience to see women pray outside, especially, like, ultra Orthodox women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to get up and touch the wall and leave a little note inside of it is really nice. It was a good experience, but just the fact that they kind of had us do this religious singing beforehand really, like, made it a little uncomfortable for me, I would say.
Okay.
If that had been optional, I would have just option to step back and let everybody have their time, but it was not optional. And that didn't feel the best to me personally.
Yeah, the thing about the singing circle was there was clearly something like affecting about that to at least the wider public around us. You know, there's a certain sense when we're going around as part of a birthright group where we have to wear, you know, the yellow lanyards. And so kind of anywhere we go, people know like, oh, there's a birthright group here. Right. And so I think there was a sense where like, you know, this group had come from America and they were visiting the Western Wall and they were like singing and, you know, having this time. And like there were a lot of general public, like Israeli people who were visiting the wall, who like clearly seemed to appreciate that this was happening. And they were like, you know, some people were like also standing around the circle and kind of like joining in the song. And it was like, it was a nice moment in that respect. But I do agree with Nina that we maybe could have sung like two verses of the song instead of eight. Because after a while, it was kind of like, we're really still doing this? And there were other participants on the trip when we went up to the Western Wall, who, like, I overheard talking. They were like, you know, oh, the sun was setting, and once the sun sets, there's certain things that you can't do there. And they were like, well, if we hadn't spent, you know, 20 minutes standing there singing, like, we would have had more time with the wall. And that was sort of emblematic of, I'd say, a bigger interesting thing about the trip, where on the one hand, it was this great experience to go and see this other country and all of these, you know, beautiful places and historic landmarks. And walking through the old city was certainly a great example of that, mm-hmm. where, you know, we saw 2,000-year-old Roman roads that had been, like, collapsed under bombings or, you know, things of that nature. And then on the other hand, we were also kind of there at a summer camp where basically the tour guides would like stop us after everything. And we'd always stand in circles and we'd do little games to be like, how did you feel about the thing you just saw? Right. And sometimes it would be like, oh, what did you think of your day hanging out in, you know, Tel Aviv? Like, what did you see? What kind of things did you do? And then other times it'd be like, how do you feel about, you know, the Holocaust Museum we just walked through? And just there's varying degrees of like, guys, we just had this experience. Like, let us go like sit on it instead of like trying to immediately sit here and do the like the more forced reflection part of it, you know?
Can we please eat lunch and then I will tell you how the Holocaust Museum made me feel.
Thank yes.
So it was all very structured, I gather.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
There were maybe three separate occasions where they said, okay, we're in this place. Just kind of go hang out. Meet us at the bus in like 3 hours or something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The rest of it was pretty much like structured tours.
Yes.
Okay. What was security like? I'm just curious, because I know as your father sitting here, you know, back home in Los Angeles, I was certainly keeping track of the news, and always stored away in the back of my mind is, well, this is a place that I personally would love to see, but I have no intention of going to because I don't want to step into a war zone. Yeah. So what was the security situation like?
So as far as our group was concerned, we had like one primary security guard. He was kind of, for the most part, felt like he was just along for the trip. But also he was the one who was open carrying like guns and things along with everyone.
He had a medical pack. I think he was like 19 though.
He certainly wasn't that old.
He was younger than anybody else there.
Was he Israeli military or was he private?
Oh, I did not ask, but I would assume he's IDF and he's in his IDF stand, like stint, you know. We had another security, I don't know if he would be considered a security guard, when the five or six Israelis joined our group when we got to Jerusalem. There was another guy in there who was working in the IDF, like he had finished his stay and chosen to like work there as a career. And I don't know if he was carrying as well, but he also had like a medical bag with him. So,
okay.
Yeah, he, at least for that, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So as far as our group was concerned, that was like the main security we got. Mm-hmm. There was also certainly, you know, we would go to, for example, a rest stop after we visited Kibbutz Dan in the north, where, you know, you're just kind of sitting here trying to enjoy your falafel, and suddenly, like, a whole roving band of IDF soldiers would show up carrying guns that are, like, you know, bigger than your chest, and they're just, like, casually going around doing whatever they're doing, which was certainly, you know, from an American perspective, a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. They just walk into the McDonald's holding their, like, huge machine gun. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, okay.
Nobody cares.
No one cares.
You've just described another day in Tennessee.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. To be fair enough.
Yeah, everybody in Israel is conscripted, I assume, for a couple of years when they're young,
yes.
Right?
Yes, for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was... one of the things that we picked up being with the Israeli citizens as part of our group was, you know, I think earlier you had asked sort of whether our perspective had shifted on kind of the political side of it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll say that before going, I was actually pretty apprehensive to tell anybody that I was going to be going to Israel, because there is this like, pretty palpable sense on things like social media where, you know, we might see that, you know, Israel seems like more of a bad guy, where they're like, you know, they have 100 million missiles compared to the Gaza Strip's like mm-hmm. 3 missiles that they're shooting at, right? And it almost, at least from an outside perspective, seems like there's this overwhelming sense of force that feels pretty unnecessary. And it's kind of like, well, why can't we just coexist, guys, you know? Mm-hmm. But one thing that I took away from talking with the Israelis was, the best way I think to describe it is, it seems like everyone in Israel has PTSD, like, to a degree.
Yes.
And part of it stems from the fact that they all have to be in the army, but also part of it stems from sort of this cultural sense that, you know, there were actually decades of time there where, like, every day there was a car bombing, or every day there was a shooting, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent where it's, you know, it's not quite comparable to something like, you know, one of the discussions we might have had on the trip was, like, Black Lives Matter, right? It's not quite the same thing in that way, where you just kind of have to come to this understanding that, like, the people in Israel have been living with like genuine terror for a long time. And I think that shifted my perspective a bit on sort of the politics there and understanding the, like, you know, the coexisting angle of it and how much harder that really is than it might seem from like an American perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think, much in the same way when we talk about like PTSD and the way that it was really being described by the Israeli participants, it brought me back to some conversations that I had had when I used to live in Japan, which I used to say to friends and a lot of men that I interacted with, which was, every woman has a train story, meaning every woman in Japan or who has lived in Japan or been to Japan has a train story about some not so great things happening or not so consensual things happening to them or another person on the train that they've witnessed, because it's just so common there, which is just to say, like, this happens all the time. You cannot pretend to be unaware of it. It is a real thing for half of your population. So when I used to say that, it kind of brought it back to me thinking, listening to all of the Israelis talk about their experiences in the way that I can say every woman has a train story. I think every Israeli has a story about someone that they knew or that their family members knew that, you know, was a victim of terror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's what it seemed like to me. It may not be actually true, but that's what I sort of took from their conversations.
Yeah, I got the same sense. And I will add, just as like a mm-hmm. preface or you know, whatever you might say to that. One of the things that I feel is important to take away is one of the good friends that we made among the Israelis gave us the perspective that it's not necessarily a thing about hate. You know, there's a sense where, like, you know, we see something like this and it's like, oh, they're just being bigots against the Arab people or something like that. But it's like, it's not quite that. There was, when we were on Shabbat in Jerusalem, there was a moment where we were doing an activity together and one of the nearby mosques started doing one of its daily prayers. And the Israeli who was in our group, like, kind of stiffened up at it. And we had talked to him about it. And he was saying, you know, he's grown up in a world where just, like, hearing Arabic comes with the sense of, like, oh, there could be someone behind you who's about to, like, you know, pull out a bomb or something like that. And when he was confronted about this idea in the group, he was very clear and outspoken about the fact that it's not something that he wants to feel. You know, it's just, like, it's such a part of life over there that it's really hard to separate that from the fact that, you know, that, you know, not every Arab person is about to try and kill you.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
And they also made another remark that, like, when they travel to other places like America or Europe or anything like that, and they hear people speaking Arabic, they don't even, like, think about it at all. They just kind of notice, and they don't expect that they're going to be stabbed or that there's going to be a terrorist attack at any moment. They kind of just see it and go, oh, yeah, that's fine, whatever. But it's the fact that they're in Israel and they're experiencing this, that's what causes, I think, a lot of PTSD in them.
Yeah, the context.
Those sorts of reactions. Yes, the context.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
So what was the Bedouin experience like that they didn't explain to you?
All right. So we got... All right, so just, like, here's to put this in context of here's what the 12 hours before this were like. So okay. We had finished Shabbat. It was New Year's. And They were like, all right, New Year's Eve, everybody go out to party in Jerusalem. Here's, you know, go have fun. So they took us out. So everyone's out. People are drinking. They're having a good time. It's great. We end up getting back to the hotel at like 11:45 because there was an issue where I think a cop pepper sprayed somebody in like a closed area where we were. Yeah. And it caused kind of a crowd rush and everybody had to get out because no one wants to be pepper sprayed. And it just was really chaotic and we didn't understand what was going on. So we just thought, okay, let's just leave. Let's just go to the hotel. We know the hotel's safe. I don't care. Let's go. So we leave. People are still drinking, having a good time. We get to the hotel. We celebrate New Year's, still like staying up late, drinking. It's midnight. I don't sleep till like 2 or 3 a.m. because I've had alcohol, so I cannot sleep no longer. Okay. So wake up, 8 a.m., get everything together, pack it all up, get on the bus. We're going to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum. Everyone is tired. Everyone is hungover. It is New Year's Day. We are in the Holocaust Museum. We get there, and then they all say, all right, strap in. This tour is about to be 3 hours long walking. Yep. No sitting, nowhere to sit. Don't sit down, no stopping. So we go, we walk for 3 hours and experience everything there is to learn about the Holocaust.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I'll add that, you know, presuming you have more of an American audience, Yad Vashem in Israel is a very extreme kind of Holocaust museum too, where the entire thing was built in a way to essentially be an allegory for the Holocaust, where you kind of walk through the way the museum is set up so that you're like going like lower into the place and like it kind of constricts and you get to the bottom and you're at the lowest, like darkest part of the museum. And, you know, it's the final solution. And then, you know, you kind of have to go through everything that happened with that before you can like walk out into the light at the end. And it's like, here's what the Jewish people have been fighting for. And you have the most beautiful view of Jerusalem that you've ever seen.
Yes.
Right? And it's like, wow, this was such a story. And then they said, all right, now let's go to the Children's Museum, where it's just a dark room full of lights. And they read out the name of children who were killed during the Holocaust. And it's like, wow, this was a really uplifting day, guys.
Yeah. That's a great way to start 2023. So we went through that. Then they gave us some food, which was good. And then we get back on the bus and they say, all right, strap in. It's a 2-hour ride to the middle of nowhere. Let's go.
Going to the desert.
Going to the desert. So we go. 2 hours later, we're in the desert. We keep driving past hostels and hotels and towns that look like they could be like somewhere. And keep going and keep going. And then we're out in the middle of the desert. And yeah. They were like, all right, we're in like sub temperatures and it's windy and it's crazy outside and no one's dressed for this. Let's go outside into the middle of the desert and like stack some rocks, you guys. So there was a rock stacking event that I could not participate in halfway through because my hands started freezing to the point that I couldn't move them. And okay. I was just standing there until one of the like tour guides said, you can go inside if you want to. And I just said, okay, just like tried to awkwardly like walk back in. I couldn't move. So we had that experience, which I don't know what we were supposed to learn or gain through that. They never told us.
I think it was something about like balance and patience and, you know, sort of like centering yourself or whatever. Not entirely sure what it had to do with the Jewish experience.
Yeah.
But there was some sort of like shamanistic, you know, internal improvement kind of aspect to that.
We got out there and we were freezing and shivering together. And I looked over at him and I said, I don't feel very close to my Jewish heritage right now, do you?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll add as a note, the fun thing was I was a little sick before going to Israel. And throughout the first like couple of days, I was maybe starting to feel better. And then we went and stood out in the desert and stacked rocks. And the rest of the trip, I was like, oh, I'm out again.
Yep.
So, I mean, I can understand the idea of, you know, a people connected to the land kind of thing and a history of, you know, this is the way the societies and the peoples lived. I mean, there's still a large number of tribal people in that part of the world that live that way, right? They travel through the desert and they pitch their tents and that's where they live for a week or whatever, and then they move on. There was no, they didn't tie any of that together.
So for the rock stacking part of it, not so much. That was just kind of like, oh, we're going to go do this activity, right? And after that, we went and found the hostel we were staying in. Everyone got to drop off their bags and everything. And then we went to the actual Bedouin encampment that we were going to be visiting that night. And the Bedouins are, you know, from what we learned, especially talking to the Israelis, they are kind of that nomadic tribe that you're describing, where a lot of them do still live by those old rules. And it seems like the encampment we were visiting is probably more of a tourist trap, if anything, that some of them have set up. And so we went and we spent the night having dinner there. And I'll add, one of the best meals of the trip, in my opinion. They had like chicken wings there, just fell off the bone. It was so good. And we got to sit around on little mats, and there were like cats wandering around the room we were in.
It was warm.
Yeah, it was very warm. It was great.
It was nice.
We didn't get much of the Bedouin experience that night, though, because the next morning we also went back. And this was where they were like, okay, let's do something fun today and go camel riding. And so that was like the big Bedouin experience we got, was we got to go experience what it would have been like to, you know, walk through the desert on a camel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were the Bedouins, were they Israeli? Were they Arab? Were they?
They were Arab.
Tour guides?
They're Arab. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of the best way to say this one. One of the things that we had heard from the Israelis is that the Bedouins are a people of extremes, let's say, where like some of them are like extremely dedicated to the Israeli cause, right? Yeah. They love the country that they're living in and the people, and they will like fight in the IDF even if they don't have to, all of these things. And then some of them are like, you know, responsible for among some of the worst terrorist attacks that like people have seen. And so that's kind of the perspective on them that we got. A lot of the actual Bedouin people at the encampment were just kind of like running the establishment. We didn't get like a big speech from them or, you know, a tour or anything like that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Feels like a missed opportunity to actually have a cultural exchange there in that moment.
Would have been a great opportunity for one of our tour guides to have been like, all right, we're going to the Bedouin camp. Let's talk about Bedouin people and what we're going to do at this camp. That never happened. Basically, we were on the bus and there was an Israeli person sitting behind us. And I turned around and said, so do you know anything about what the Bedouins like are? Because they've told us nothing. And like, I feel kind of like, we're not getting any information out of this. And I think it would make it better if I understood literally anything about Bedouin people. And so that's where we got that kind of, they live in extremes, speech.
Right.
And at least that explains something, you know, some information there. All right. Okay. It was a tourist moment.
Yeah. Like I said, a lot of the trip was kind of in that weird gray space of like, okay, you're here to experience this culture in this new place. But also, you're at summer camp, so we got to kind of, like, send you to the fun activities, and then, oh no, we're late to the next thing. Get on the bus.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know whether you guys have been exposed to either of these two pieces of culture, but I highly recommend it. And you might have a total different appreciation for it now that you've actually been there. You have to watch Lawrence of Arabia if you want to understand... I think the Bedouin experience and how the Ottomans changed the Middle East and how it formed afterwards, because it's a, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is literally how the British came in at the end of the Ottoman War and created the partition that would lead to the chaos that we ultimately wound up with at the far end. Mm-hmm. And the other is the book Exodus by Leon Uris, which talks about the Jewish experience of the founding of Israel, including from the perspective of Holocaust survivors getting out of Europe and trying to get there as a place to go when the Jews were living in the refugee camps in Europe, because after liberating from the Nazis, nobody knew what to do with them, right? I mean, 6 million are dead. There's so many people left. They're not welcome anywhere anymore. They no longer have homes. And all most of them wanted to do at that point was get to either America, which was considered a safe space, or get to Israel, which was, you know, their ancestral homeland. And I've read them both. I've watched one. I've read the other. Really worthwhile stuff, because I think it'll give you, especially now that you've experienced it, it will give you a perspective. I think that is really cool. So. My thought on it.
Yeah.
So you're done in the desert. You're half frozen. You get back on the bus. What happened next?
So after the camel riding, we went to Mount Masada and we got to hike up Mount Masada.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to hike up the mountain and go see the ruins of an ancient Jewish civilization that existed during the Roman times. And so the main story with that is there were a group of Jewish people living around the area that escaped slavery from the Romans, and they found Mount Masada, and they found the sort of old Roman ruins of a sort of town civilization that had like an aqueduct, I guess, in it as well. And so they decided to set up camp and start living there, and they made a life for, I think, about 8 years on top of the mountain, because it was a strategic place to be. You could see people coming from all directions, you know, at the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And eventually the Roman army found them again and made a plan to come up and massacre all of the Jewish people living there. So the story is that they decided to commit suicide and die free, and mm-hmm. you know, rather than becoming slaves again. So that is the main story. And so that becomes a heritage site for a lot of Jewish people.
Yeah. It's definitely a famous story that we all learned. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And I'd say one of the most interesting things about going there is that the Israeli government like sets up like an actual connection to the, you know, the Jewish faith, like for the site, where literally if you go to the old synagogue, which is just like, you know, half walls and some seats inside, there's also a little room where a rabbi just spends literally every day of his life just inside this tiny room copying the Torah like over and over again repeatedly, so that it can be a place that's like, you know, it's connected to the people, it's connected to the faith. Like,
so I'll ask you this, I probably know the answer, but I'm going to ask you this. You do realize that every single copy of the scrolls, the Torah scrolls in every temple around the world are handwritten?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, literally, it's like this tourist attraction, essentially, where everyone can just stand around and watch the rabbi, like, write the Torah over and over again.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had gone up the mountain on the old Roman path that they had built to go and, you know, massacre the Jews. And then we went down the other side, just a much longer path, even though there was like a gondola going over us the whole time, where it was like, yeah, that probably would have been nice. because by the time we got to the bottom, our next stop was the Dead Sea. And the idea was we were going to go down there. And for some reason, they decided the stopping point for the Dead Sea for us was going to be a shopping mall just on the edge of it. So we kind of landed there and they were like, yeah, so we're running a little late and we got to get to Tel Aviv on the other end of this. So, you got like an hour and a half, go eat and enjoy the Dead Sea. It was like, okay.
Yeah. And
eating wasn't really an option, at least for us.
We wasted an hour trying to find a place to eat and just gave up.
Yeah,
were there a lot of settlements on the Dead Sea itself?
We didn't, like, I don't think we explored thoroughly enough to have a good sense of that.
Okay.
Essentially, the place that we went to was like, it was like a hotel resort kind of area where it was like there was a few almost skyscrapery buildings and a shopping mall and, you know, some nice beaches.
Very modern, sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty modern spot. Okay. But we did get to go in the Dead Sea. And, you know, you sort of hear stories about how, oh, you go in and it's so salty that you float. But it's hard to convey just how odd it is to be in the water and have it be so much of a struggle to, like, push your limbs under the water. It's like... just trying to stand after being in there is just like trying to force your legs down. And it's like, it's really interesting and it's cool, but it's also like, wow, there's like nothing else like this really.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You reach down into the thing and you think you're going to pull out sand and it's just salt. It's just rocks of salt.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That was the other interesting thing is like, you know, in California we have beaches where it's like, oh, it's a bunch of shells everywhere and it's kind of like sharp and, you know, it's not super comfortable to walk in it, and I thought it was going to be like that, but it turns out the whole seafloor there is just calcified salt.
Wow. Okay. We have something close to that here in the U.S. in the Great Salt Lake in Utah is similar. So interesting. All right, so you did the Dead Sea. Then you went to Tel Aviv, And how was that? Tel Aviv is Tel Aviv an all modern city, or is Tel Aviv a modern city built on top of an ancient city?
I would call it an all modern city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there is. So while we were there, we visited Jaffa, which is like basically the ancient port settlement there that, you know, Tel Aviv like kind of branched out of, or it was like, it was like a little place there, and then Tel Aviv had started somewhere else, and Tel Aviv kind of grew to the point that it like consumed Jaffa, and it's like, so it's like a little pocket of the city is the old city, but other than that, it's, you know, the best way I could think to describe it is we visited a neighborhood called Florentine, which is, you know, it was described as being a very, like, it's a very young neighborhood. You know, you go around and there's, like, graffiti everywhere, and there's, like, a very, like, young culture generally. And I'd say the best way to describe it is it felt a lot like San Francisco, just without the hills.
It's like San Francisco, Portland kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's hipster. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of high-tech industry in Tel Aviv. A lot.
Yes. Very true. Big.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. We got kind of the dichotomy of that while we were there, cuz the tour that we went on was it was like an industry tour. There was a couple of them you could choose from. It was like one of them is for industry, one of them was for food, and one of them was for art. And on the industry tour, you know, kind of the lesson of the day for the summer camp was it was about gentrification. And so we got to go see, like, you know, an old workshop where it's like a 70-year-old man is making the arcs that people place Torahs in. Mm-hmm. And it's like entirely by hand, like him and maybe three other people like working under him. Just this like really specific ancient craft. And, you know, then later on, the stop on the tour we hit was like this modern art store where the gimmick was they use some like Swedish app that animates the things you're looking at, right? And kind of the idea was like, you know, as people like this first craftsman die, you don't really know what happens to that industry, because so much of it now is, you know, we use machines and all of these things that take a lot of the, you know, the quote-unquote heart out of it.
Yeah.
And while that's all like a big tragedy, they were like, but also look at all the high tech stuff that we do in Israel. Right? We have fancy art things. And so that was sort of the idea behind the tour we went on.
The world changes.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. How long were you in Tel Aviv for before you came home?
2 days-ish.
Okay.
Yeah, thereabouts. 2 days in the worst hotel room you've ever seen.
Yes.
I guess they spent all the money on the hotel in Jerusalem, it sounds like.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Tel Aviv's a very nice city. I do wish we got to see more of it, because the one day that we got to spend kind of touring the city on our own was great. Yeah. You know, we got to like go to a wonderful shawarma restaurant, and we got to see a bunch of different markets. I don't know. I do wish we saw more of it, because one of my favorite parts of the trip was Tzavat early on, where it's like, it is this very like ancient feeling city that's like built up in the mountains, but also just like there's just a couple mile stretch in the center of the city where we're visiting that it's just like art galleries all over the place. And it's like, it's this weird like artist alley that's like everywhere here is part of the same industry. And it was like, it was beautiful.
Was that your first stop on the trip? That Tzavat was the first city, the one that was up near the border with Syria?
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to you while you were there, and I'm Wikipediaing the place, right? And I'm like, kid, do you realize that that place was founded 1500 years before Christ? Uh-huh. It's like, what did that feel like? So for me, one of the most amazing parts of traveling is experiencing the culture and the history of the place, right? I went to London for the first time back in 1984, and I was lucky enough, and it was my first time outside of the US when I went to London, but I grew up and I lived in New York City, which is actually a place in the US that still has a sense of its own history, right? You go down to Trinity Church on Wall Street, and you've got a church that's there from almost the founding, and you know, there are founding fathers of the country buried in the churchyard right over there amongst all of the large skyscrapers around it, which Los Angeles, unfortunately, doesn't have a great sense of its own history. It has a tendency of tearing everything down and rebuilding it every 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the feeling, I'm in London, I'm surrounded by all of this, you know, Victorian construction around me. I go to Westminster Abbey. I got to go down into the crypts, and there's the crypt of Sir Isaac Newton. And I'm like, you know, my head explodes at that point. I'm so overwhelmed and washed over by the history of that place and what I'm surrounded by. You guys, you know, you went pre-Renaissance, right? You went all the way back to pretty much the beginning of what is recorded history. What was that like? No good answer on that one.
It's a big question because it was a lot.
It was.
I definitely, you know, we were talking earlier about not being the most religious people necessarily. Yeah. And so, for example, going to the Western Wall, you know, like we were talking about it earlier, I didn't have a hugely like religious experience with it. Instead, kind of what you take away is like, oh, this place has been here thousands of years. And, you know, I'm going to leave a little piece of paper here and it's going to, you know, it's going to get swept up next week and like they're going to start over or whatever. But it's like it's this tradition that people have been doing for who knows how long. Right. And places like the Old City or Jaffa, like, definitely had that kind of gravity to them where it was like, wow, this has been here thousands of years and like has affected the arc of pretty much human history. I don't know that I have a good thing I'm leading toward with that, but I think the gravity was certainly there.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think I feel very similar in that it's just, I don't have the religious background to emotionally back myself up on it. Mm-hmm. It's really just something I'm seeing with my eyes and just experiencing visually. And I think that's it. In some sense, I felt a little bit bad. I remember when we went to the Western Wall and all of the women on our group came back sobbing and crying like it had been like a life-changing experience for them, and I was the only one who didn't. And I kind of said to our tour group, like, am I a bad person? I didn't cry. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. Can you explain to me what I should feel right now? Because I just don't think I have it. I don't have any solid ground to stand on right now for this. And he kind of just said, you know, some people do, some people don't. Doesn't mean you're bad if you don't. You know, it's different for everybody. I don't know what they're feeling. I don't know what they're going on for them, but it's a personal thing for them. So if it's not affecting you personally, you don't have to worry about it so much. And that was a nice thing to hear because it often felt like a lot of the things that we were doing, you know, that are supposed to be extremely emotional experiences maybe didn't hit me in that way. I can understand mm-hmm. the gravity of them, and I totally respect how people will feel and react to them. But personally, for me, it's not something that's gonna like make me cry or have like a really overwhelming emotional experience to it. It's just I experience it and I go on. So I took that for the rest of the trip and said, okay, look, I'm not gonna make myself feel bad if I don't,
connect
with everything.
Absolutely right. Yeah, the beauty of travel is you get to experience all these different places, and it enriches your life in some way, right? Mm-hmm. You learn about other cultures, you learn about different people, if you get to meet the people there, you get to understand what their experience of living is like, right? Because Americans have this notion in their heads of American exceptionalism, and we're special and we're different. And then you go someplace else and you go, no, we just have a different set of experiences than these other people do. And you know, if you have a healthy outlook on it, it's not about I'm better than you. It's just I'm different. And like for me, again, it's always when I travel, it's about when I get emotionally involved in a place, because of what I'm looking at, it's about the weight of, I'm a history buff for a lot of things. So it's the weight of knowing that I'm standing in front of something that, you know, has been actively populated by people for, 5,000 years and has all this history behind it that winds up getting me. It's like the thing that got me when I was in London was that I was standing in front of Isaac Newton's tomb. Not so much that I was, you know, standing in Westminster Abbey. It's like being an engineer and all that. That was such a significant idea that I'm looking at where somebody who was that important in the world had his final resting place, had it. But yeah, it's always a very personal experience when you're doing these things.
Yeah. So. And I think to kind of your point about, you know, appreciating the history and, you know, even if you're not having that kind of an experience with it, one of the things that I liked about Sabat in particular is, you know, it's not just this like really nice, like mountain city with like this thriving artist community. That's like, you know, just kind of a beautiful place to be in. They were also telling us it's one of the like the four, you know, I forget the terminology they use, but it's like one of the four big like religious centers in Israel, right? It's like it's like there are four different cities where you can trace different aspects of like, you know, the religious side of Judaism too. And for Tzavat, it's like where the concept of Kabbalah was first created, right? And so it's like, this is like literally where they said, okay, let's look at Judaism and give it more of a like spiritual connection. Mm-hmm. And so one of the places we visited was a synagogue that was named after the, you know, I think it was like the father of Kabbalah. And it's like, wow, this is like a like genuine kind of like religious site that's interesting in that way. But also it's just this like gorgeous little synagogue with like, you know, a beautiful mural of sort of the like the hills and mountainsides around you that you can go see. And then you walk outside and it's like you're wandering down, you know, this really old road where you can go and get iced coffee at the bottom. And it's like, you know, there is that sense where you can appreciate the history and also just be like, wow, look at sort of the modern community that has sprung out of that.
Is it weird? Is it weird to experience that juxtaposition of ancient and modern in the same place at the same time? Was it like bizarre to, you know, be in a Starbucks that's built in a 2,000-year-old building? I know that's extreme, but
I don't think we saw a 2,000-year-old Starbucks.
They don't have Starbucks in Israel because apparently everything is run by a monopoly.
Yeah, so that's true. Apparently,
they don't have like a lot of brands.
One tea company that owns everything.
Yes.
Over there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. It might have felt different for Jason, but for me, it kind of just feels like every other place you've been to. You know, it's like I've been to a lot of different countries where there's, of course, you know, in your experience, you want to get as much as you can of the modern juxtaposed with the historical and the cultural side of things. So, you know, like, for example, in Korea, you can walk to like one of their like, you know, biggest historical like old castles. that monarchs used to live in at the time. And then down the street, you can go shopping for skincare products in like big skincare area. So, you know, it's the way it is now. I think every city has some amount of that to an extent.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure I'd say anything in particular about like the religiosity of the cities per se, where like certainly going to see the old city in Jerusalem is like, you know, you can feel the difference being there as far as how things are built and sort of maybe some of the reverence people have toward them. But, you know, like I was saying earlier, the part of Tel Aviv that we visited felt a lot like San Francisco. And Jerusalem, in a lot of ways, kind of felt like LA, like driving through it. But I think the place where it stood out the most was in seeing the different kinds of people living in Israel, where, you know, there are the very, very religious folks walking around in basically the stereotype you'd expect of, like, you know, the really nice, like, black suits and suits, you know, they have
white shirts, pants, curly hair,
everything like that. And so you'd see that kind of thing all over the place. And then you would talk to, or, you know, we would talk to the Israeli participants that are with us. And apparently it's like a big thing over there where there are constantly arguments about, you know, how much does that really religious sect of people like contribute to the society, where it's like, you know, because they've dedicated their life to the Torah and sort of the Jewish spiritual side of it, they don't have to, you know, be part of the IDF, and they don't have to, you know, do certain other contributions. And you kind of get almost that difference in the people in a lot of way, where it's like, there's the very like, they'd follow the ancient traditions and so on and so forth. And then there's the more modern side of it, and feels more like that than in like the cities themselves.
It definitely felt like the general consensus amongst the Israelis that we were, you know, having on our trip, because most of them were pretty modernized people. Some of them weren't even very religious at all. You know, they were very similar to us in a lot of ways. And then some of them were more Orthodox. Their general consensus was like, those people don't represent our society. Why should their group be the one in charge of the government? So you can tell that there's a lot of tension with that specifically.
Yeah, that was kind of the next question I was going to throw at you, and not necessarily expecting the response back was, okay, is Israel a theology? Is Israel a democratic society, or is it a theologic society? Is it theocracy or a democracy?
Well, I'm not in a position to answer that because I don't know anything about Israeli politics, or at least any more than I got on that trip. It doesn't seem like it's a democracy, but it would really depend on who you asked.
I'm in the same boat. I don't know that I'm qualified enough to speak on it. Just like, you know, sort of the general sense we got.
Is it always all about religion, or is it, you know, religion is just an important part of the society there?
I'd say in a lot of cases the religion like wasn't even that important to a lot of the people we talked to.
I
was talking earlier about one of the like Jewish identity activities we did. Like, there was, you know, sort of this, in the end, when we came back together, there was a sense that all of the American participants had come to a very similar conclusion, where the most important thing about being Jewish is like having the community, having kind of the traditions that you could all do together, right? It all kind of goes back to that side of it. And for the Israelis, most of them pretty much agreed that the most important thing is like fighting for your homeland, right? The idea of Israel as the homeland, as like the Jewish state that we should fight for, seems way more important than like, you know, the fact that you're going there to practice Judaism.
Interesting. Okay. Last question, then I'll let you guys off of this one. Best meal that you had while you were there.
Ooh. I have a think.
There was a lot of good ones.
There was a lot of great ones. I will say, I liked the shawarma place we went to in Tel Aviv, mm-hmm. and that was recommended to us by someone who, actually a person who had gone on Birthright and decided to move to Israel and stay. So he lived in Tel Aviv and he knew a lot of local places, so we were directed to go there by him, and good choice. Absolutely. Yes. Perfect shawarma. Yeah. The way they put it in the falafel, it was like a little art show, almost.
I was going to say the same thing. They're just like layers of meat, yeah. and then layers of vegetable, and then do some mm-hmm. sauce, and then layers of meat again. Yeah. It was a whole presentation to it.
Is this one of those places that's like been there for 1,000 years and the same family runs it kind of thing? Or was it, you know, a modern restaurant?
Modern restaurant by most standards. But they just, like, the way they had to do this, the way they did the presentation was like that they took so much care and you could like watch them setting it up. It's like they put love into it, you know. It's very cliche to say, but it's like they were really taking their time and making sure that it was perfect. And so you feel like there's a little bit of like love and artistry with the food that they're creating.
They'd also, you know, they'd ask, you know, do you want everything in it? Yes. You want the spicy sauce? Yes. And they'd be like, good. You know, there's very clearly a sense that they expect the chorus to come around and ask for all the substitutions. And so they're like, you want to have this like the way we make it, right?
Yeah. Nice.
What were you going to say?
I think we're going to say the same thing.
I think we're going to say the same thing. Yeah.
The kanafe.
Yes.
In Jaffa, yeah.
there's, I guess, a Middle Eastern dessert. Which is, it's the best way to explain it. It's like
thin glass vermicelli noodles mm-hmm. that are fried till they're crunchy
mm-hmm.
On top of cottage cheese that's like kind of melted and gooey and warm.
Yeah, and it's then, almost like a pastry.
Yeah, in a way. So cottage cheese on the bottom, then the noodles that are mm-hmm. cooked. And then on top of it, they put like this kind of sugary syrup sauce that's orange. And then they do some like drizzles with like clotted cream or something. You
know, I think one of the ones we had, I don't know if it was the one in Jaffa or in Jerusalem, they used like rose water.
Yes, and rose water. They put some pistachios on top of it. And then they also add like Turkish ice cream. So you have it together. And it's so sweet and so good, and it was a great thing for us because the first day we got to Jerusalem, we like immediately made friends with one of the Israeli people there, and he took us around and said like, all right, I want to have you guys try kanafe because this is my favorite dessert. It's either gonna be godly or awful, so we don't know. So he got us one and we were both like, this is really good. I like it. I don't care. It's great. He's like, no, this is the worst.
This is trash.
This is absolute garbage food. No. And we kept trying to find better ones while we were together. But in the end, he just kind of had to like send us some recommendations over chat. And then we went and we found one in Jaffa and he was right. That one was 100 times better.
It's like a different experience.
Nice.
I guess I'll also put in a good word for what was the one that he brought us to in Jerusalem? The eggplant dish.
I wish I could remember the name, but it was a falafel. So everything you would experience in like a falafel sandwich, but no falafel, instead like a grilled marinated eggplant.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Real nice. Good.
Great.
Yes.
So overall for the trip, yay or nay?
I definitely give it a yay. Yeah. I would recommend, obviously, people who have the opportunity and certainly who can go on Birthright, because it's free, should take advantage of doing that. But if I was going to go again, I would definitely want to like go on my own and not kind of be like sent on their little tour.
Yes, absolutely.
Tours are definitely hard.
Great.
Awesome, guys. Thanks for taking the time to tell me about it. Sounds like it was a spectacular trip and a lot to take away from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.